Good evening, I'm Lee Hay, and I'd like to share with you a conversation between Brian O'Donnell and Doug Yeager. A few weeks ago, Jim Hunt approached me with a possible interview with his friend Doug Yeager. Here's what Jim said about him. Doug Yeager will do a screening of his documentary film Free to Rock at UC on November 30th. The film, narrated by Kiefer Sutherland, presents a compelling story of how American rock and roll helped overthrow the Soviet Union. The film's been shown in universities and consulates all over the world. Doug's from Cincinnati, graduated from Wyoming High School, and was one of the founders of the rock club Reflections. He's worked in the music business over 40 years, specializing in managing and representing musical performers such as Tom Paxton, Richie Havens, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Odetta, Josh White Jr., and many more. So tonight, a conversation with Brian O'Donnell and Doug Yeager, and Doug's memories of Cincinnati's rock scene back in the day, and his film Free to Rock on WVXU.
Doug, I look forward to you coming back to Cincinnati. It's going to be a great time with your new film called Free to Rock over at UC in the Main Street Cinema. Now, you're a native of Cincinnati, aren't you? You went to Wyoming. You're a Wyoming cowboy, correct?
Boy, you even know the Cowboys. Yes, went to Wyoming High School and then came to the University of Cincinnati. And except for going to college in Aix-en-Provence, France, between the two schools, I majored in international relations and thought I was going to be a foreign war correspondent. However, things changed.
In what direction did you take then?
Well, what happened was, while I was going to school in France, a guy I considered my older brother, Daniel Wolf, he was the town coordinator at the Round Table nightclub in Clifton. And he sends me a letter and he says, I've got some great acts here. I think they'd love them in Europe. Can you book a tour? And I wrote him back and I said, well, I've got to go to Tunisia to write a research paper. But when I get back, send me what you have and I'll see what I can do. It was that nonchalant. And he sent me a package which had the names of three acts: Ivan and the Sabres, Strangers in Town, and Diane Dittmar. No photos, and a tape that I couldn't find. I couldn't find one tape recorder in France to play it.
This is the reel-to-reel tape, I assume.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We're talking 52 years ago. So I didn't have much of a promotional package, and dressed in the best clothes I could have as a college student, and a sport coat, and I started at Monte Carlo, because everybody told me the biggest nightclubs in Europe are on the French Riviera in the summer. So I started in Monte Carlo and started working my way down. And nobody had any interest in what I was saying. And of course, I was speaking Franglais. I wasn't dressed like a jet setter. And so I was just this hick from the Midwest of America. I was trying to sell something to the jet set. And I had failed in like 5-6 cities coming down. And I was taking a bus to my last city. And I said, if this doesn't work, then I'm going back to Aix-en-Provence and continue my plan to be a war correspondent. And I came to this town called Saint-Tropez, and checked into a hotel, asked them about the clubs, and they say, well, there's three big ones here in town. One's just a block away. And so I went over, and the guy loved everything I had to say. Now, maybe my pitch had improved some, but it was just the fact, and I didn't realize at the time, that no American bands had ever toured Europe at the time. They had black artists. They had Otis Redding and Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, Sam and Dave, Wilson Pickett, and those are the acts. The Stax acts out of Memphis, that they would send tours over to Europe. But regular white American bands, I guess you would call it, they just didn't have them in Europe. Elvis had never played in Europe. The Beach Boys hadn't yet come to Europe. And so he was thinking differently than all the others. He said, we always had British bands here. Who did White or Shade of Pale?
Procol
Harum had just been there, but they didn't have American acts. And so we just brought over these acts, and they thought they were famous acts in America that they had just never heard of in Europe. Diane Dittmars became a big star in France and Europe and had her own TV show in Geneva. And she had been studying at UC, Conservatory of Music and Television. She stayed there for, I guess, about 8 years. And then when she came back, I introduced her to a theater producer here, and they got married and had a family. So I brought them together. The next year, we had Freddie Myers' band, Salvation and His Army. And Freddie had been the drummer in the original Ivan and the Sabres. And he had a wooden leg and couldn't dance like James Brown, his idol. So he sat behind the drums and sang and played. But he worked with the company in Dayton that manufactured artificial limbs. And he told them what he wanted. And they met for weeks and figured out that if you put a hydraulic pump in the knee, then you could kick out and it would come back, as opposed to just a hinge on it, like the old legs. And because this kid wanted to dance like James Brown, everybody in the world then had an artificial leg with that pump in the middle at the knee joint. And Freddie became a big star there. Two of the regulars every summer in Saint-Tropez were Eddie Barclay, the owner of Barclay Records, the biggest record company in France, and Bridget Bardot. Bridget, she just fell in love with Freddie, and she and Bardot formed a record company just for him. And Freddie is still there after all these years, after 50 years. And we had another act, Dave and JJ. Together, they were like Sam and Dave, and one of them would do James Brown, one would do Otis Redding. Together, they'd do Sam and Dave, and we took a band from UC called the Dynamics, and they backed them up, and we took them to Europe, and they became stars there. And then we found a 15-year-old girl in the Lower West End singing in a bar. And at 15, she could sing every note for note like Aretha Franklin. And we took her over. Her name is Randy Crawford. And she went on to sell 40 million albums. And I still talk regularly to Randy. I talk regularly to Freddie and Diane Dittmars.
Well, how is Randy and where is Randy? I remember seeing Randy Crawford at the old Buccaneer Inn on Reading Road.
With Dee Felice.
With Dee Felice, correct.
Sure.
Is she doing well these days?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. She lives in Los Angeles. A few months back, she did her first tour in about 2 or 3 years. What she had done is her current manager also managed the Crusaders.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she and the Crusaders had that big hit 40 years ago called Street Life.
I play the street life because there's no place I can go. Street life, it's the only life I know. Street life, and there's a thousand parts to play. Street life, until you play your life away. You let the people see just who you wanna be. And every night you shine just like a superstar. That's how the life is played. A tempting masquerade. You dress, you walk, you talk. You're who you think you are. Street life, you can run away from time. Street life, for a nickel or a dime. Street life, but you better not get old.
As the Crusaders broke up, Joe Sample continued with the band. So she and Joe Sample would tour together. And though Street Life was the only hit she had in America, in Europe for the decade of the 80s, she was Warner Brothers' biggest selling artist with a slew of hit records.
And I think in Japan, too, wasn't she?
Absolutely. Platinum records in Japan. And so, though she never moved to Europe, that's where she had her greatest success. And this tour a few months ago, which was the first one in 2 or 3 years, played like Carnegie Hall type theaters all across Europe, and everyone was sold out in advance.
Hey, getting back to your pitching these Cincinnati bands to the nightclub there, was that successful even without the reel-to-reel tape player? You couldn't play them any music, or did you end up having to?
Nope. It was just my gift of gab.
Oh, boy.
I had never seen the artist. I mean, in the first group. I'd seen Ivan the Sabres at some battle of the band at Cincinnati Gardens. I didn't know Diane. I didn't know strangers in town. Though they all became my closest friends and still are. And Strangers in Town had a local hit record called Inside Outside. But I was describing these imaginary groups, and I had no tape to play anybody.
That's amazing.
And they just trusted me.
Just amazing.
So that's how I began. But because the Vietnam War was going on, I had to stay in college so that I didn't get sent to war. So when I came back to UC, I just continued, and that's when Daniel Wolf, like my older brother, and Ken Cornell and I decided, with Bob Ossenbeck, who owned this property at the corner of Vine and Calhoun, to build Reflections. We did that from the ground up, and after the foundation was laid, we literally hired 50 hippies who were just sleeping in closets, and I think we paid them $1.50 an hour, and they were happy to have the work and the fact that they could dress as they normally do and have long hair, because in those days you couldn't get jobs anywhere with long hair and a beard. And so that's how we built Reflections.
One of the best concerts I've ever seen happened there. It was, I would imagine, 1970, 71. It was Boz Scaggs came in.
Oh, yeah.
A large
Columbia
band.
Records.
10, 12 member band, a lot of horns. It was just a great, great show. And so many others.
Yes.
Talk about some of the other concerts that came through there. C-Train, Chuck Berry, Little Feat.
Very good. Good memory. Mm-hmm. Yeah, C-Train were an amazing group, but, you know, they only stayed together about a year. Little Feat, actually, that first year, 1970, they were still trying to break. And Warner Brothers, because in those days you had record companies promoting artists, supporting them. Whenever they'd come through the Midwest, they would ask if, you know, we had an open date. So they played 3 times at Reflections that first year, helped build their market in Cincinnati. But the first concert we actually did was the James Gang. And Sandy Nasson, a local jazz guitarist, opened the show for them.
Sandy used to be a lifeguard at the pool I went to as a young fellow. He lived on my street, in fact, in a little golf manor. Yeah. And I think he's in Arizona now and has been for a long time.
Phoenix, Arizona now.
We're chatting with Doug Yeager. Doug has co-written, co-produced a documentary film called Free to Rock. And we're going to get to that. I promise we're going to get to that in just a couple of minutes. But Doug was also one of the co-owners of Reflections, the great club that used to be at Vine and Calhoun in Clifton. The Allman Brothers Band played there. Yes played there.
The Allman Brothers Band, the group Yes, to be honest, we had a fire limit of 1,500 people, but we sold 2,001 tickets for Yes.
There you go.
That was our most crowded concert. And of course, there aren't many clubs in the country that would hold that many people outside of Las Vegas. And we were one of the largest in the country. That's why we were able to get national and international acts. And you mentioned Chuck Berry. That was a memorable night. It was an 8 o'clock concert, as normally they were. And Chuck's contract calls that you just hire a local band to back him up. No rehearsal, because in 1970, every rock band in the world knew every Chuck Berry lick. And they knew all his songs. And so they're on the stage just kind of jamming, and Chuck shows up at 8 o'clock, and they bring him into my office. He's carrying a guitar, and he's carrying a briefcase. I say hello. He doesn't say hello. He puts down his guitar. He then puts his briefcase on the table, as he told me, he said, I've come for my payment. Because in the business, what you do is you send 50% deposit for the act, and then you pay the remainder when they arrive before they go on stage. And so he said, I've come for my money. And he opens a briefcase and pulls out the longest .45 revolver I've ever seen. It reminded me of the one Wyatt Earp on TV used to have, the Buttonline special. And he puts it right in my face. And I remember looking at him. I wasn't scared. I said, well, gee, Chuck, you don't have to do that to get paid. I'm happy to pay you. And I went and opened the safe and gave him his money. And he said, well, take me down to the stage. So now we go down. We had an exit by the stage in Reflection. So Chuck and I walked down the sidewalk on Vine and then came in the back door. The band's on stage. He opens his guitar. He opens his case, takes his guitar out, walks up the stairs. And as he is walking to the center mic and putting the plug in his guitar, he says to them, first song is Johnny Be Good. And they went right into it. Contract called for 60 minutes. And normally, some acts like the Allman Brothers will play for 3 hours as they did at Reflection.
Right.
But uncannily, I swear, as the second hand hit 60 minutes, he finished his last song, turned right, went down into the dressing room, put his guitar in his case, walked out the door where his limousine was waiting, and he was gone. We didn't know where he was staying, and no encore. But I wasn't angry. I wasn't mad, because I can imagine a guy that started doing this in the 1940s in racist Missouri, segregated Missouri, you know, probably half of his dates he never got paid. And so I understood where he was coming from. And a few years later, after I left Reflections and was managing Les Variations, we were out in Los Angeles doing the Midnight Special and a show with Dick Clark. And our publicist was dating Chuck at the time. So he invited us all over to his place for lunch. And so here I have these two sides of Chuck, you know, the leisure, semi-leisure Chuck. He was always guarded. But I'm glad I have both sides of those to tell my Chuck Berry stories.
Oh, yeah.
We had, Edgar Winter and White Trash.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of the founders of British blues rock, Long John Baldry. Oh. Coochie and the Man of the King of Rock and Roll. That was his single at the time.
Boogie Woogie.
Don't lay no boogie woogie.
I'm the king of rock and roll.
That's right.
Yeah.
We had Velvet Underground, and I remember two-thirds through the concert, the bass player just fell straight back and stopped playing and was there laying on the floor. None of the musicians stopped. No one came to see if he was alive or not. And then when the show was over, they woke him up. And that was what you would expect that from Velvet Underground. Oh,
you're killing me. You're killing me.
And we had Cheech and Chong.
I was just going to ask about that. How did that go?
It went great. And Martin Mull, I think this was around the time there was a National Entertainment Conference at the Convention Center downtown. And so a lot of these acts, besides playing at that conference, wanted to showcase somewhere else. And so we got Bonnie Raitt and Martin Mull and Cheech and Chong. And it was a lot of fun, I'll tell you that. And the Allman Brothers were special because Dwayne Allman and Barry Oakley were the original band.
Yeah.
With Dwayne and Barry were still there before they died.
And an early appearance by Genesis as well.
Well, that's right. Genesis. And, I mean, I could go on and on with just so many acts. Not all of them were big hits. Peter Eden did our ads for WBN and SAI. He was from New York, and he loved the Brooklyn Bridge. So he talked me into bringing Brooklyn Bridge in, and it was about half full, I think. But it was a fun time, and I remember our first Christmas show, we had Popeye Maupin, the lovable Santa Claus figure for all young kids in Cincinnati and Mount Adams. We had him dressed up as Santa Claus, and I miss Popeye a lot.
Yeah, unmistakable voice.
And Bobby Fries, who I'd been friends with since 1963, I think, who was a filmmaker in Cincinnati, then went to New York, became John Lennon's partner, he and Steve Gebhardt, in making John and Yoko's films. And then he produced Ladies and Gentlemen, the Rolling Stones, and directed that. Bobby still lives in Cincinnati, or he's living there now. I just spoke to him the other day. And he and another friend bought Arlen's department store chain. Remember, there were two big chains like Walmart's. They were Arlen's and Zayer's.
Mm-hmm.
So they went into Chapter 11 and then hired all their friends, of which I was one, to become a senior vice president. So with whatever money there was left, we redid the stores, and I had the idea of that we needed a Ronald McDonald type figure. And Bobby had played guitar for Popeye when he was in high school, and so we brought Popeye up to become Popeye Arlen's. And we did all of the commercials of every product. We've just all one night, and then we dressed him up as a sultan with beautiful girls and had a band and sent him around for the reopening of all the stores. And it was one of Popeye's last great moments.
Mm.
But
wow.
I have a lot of fond memories from Cincinnati, and that's why I'm so appreciative that University of Cincinnati is bringing me in. And I have to say that they were encouraged to do it by the old keyboard player, Freddie Myers, Salvation Army Band, who's now a prominent Cincinnati attorney, Joe Shea, and Denny Jansen, who used to be a sports announcer in Cincinnati, who used to come to Reflections often. And so Joe Shea and Denny Jansen got the professors at UC to become interested enough to bring me in, and I'm thankful to them.
That's great. And there's going to be a screening of your documentary film, Free to Rock, followed by a discussion and Q&A. This is going to be happening this coming Friday at the University of Cincinnati's Main Street Cinema on campus there. The things will get underway about 12 noon or so with the Q&A afterwards. And we're going to talk about that, I promise, in just a second. Go back to Chuck Berry again. How much did he get paid? Do you recall?
Yes, it was $2,500.
Okay, that sounds like good money back then.
Well, it was. And so we had sent him $1,250, and it was all secretive. He would never tell you what flight he was on, where he was staying. You just had to trust that Chuck Berry would show up. And it was an honor to have worked with him, even in the strange circumstances it was.
What was the lifespan of Reflections? Did it open in 1970?
We opened in 1970. We started building in 69. And as I said, I was still matriculated at UC. My grades weren't too good while building Reflections, but we opened 1970, and it continued. I left in 72, moved to New York, or based my business out of New York. I still kept a place in Cincinnati, and then in November of 72, then I brought Les Variations on Tour of America and based them in Cincinnati, and we had a big house on Straight Street across from, is that Deaconess Hospital?
Mm-hmm.
Right off of Clifton?
Yeah.
And the big garage out back, we converted into a recording studio. And they were there till they broke up on Christmas of 1975. They terrorized all the young girls of Cincinnati. And, you know, if you remember them, they wore high platform sequence shoes,
yeah.
You know, like inch heels and these bright sequined outfits, and the singer at times would have mascara and lipstick on, and I mean they were just, you know, compared to Cincinnati's favorite group at the time was the Pure Prairie League, so this was quite a change.
Yeah.
In fact, I got a call. Oh my, I can't think of his name. He was a good friend, a concert promoter in Cincinnati, and he called me up and he said, "Doug," he said, "RCA's interest in Pure Prairie League. Can you do a showcase concert for them? I mean, you know, actually do a concert with them and sell tickets." And the guy flew in from RCA and signed the Pure Prairie League.
Oh, nice.
So I was happy about that.
Was that promoter Russ Todd by any chance?
No, but I did work with Russ with Late Variations. I remember he promoted a concert down at Music Hall with Sean on Late Variations. And Roger Abramson.
Okay, yeah.
And I worked a lot with the Belkin brothers out of Cleveland, and Hank LeConte in Cleveland, and then his nephew ran the Agora Club in Columbus, a 2,000-seat club on High Street in Columbus. And so we would often try, when national acts come through, to book Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati. and that way we could get them for reasonable prices. But, you know, it was always fascinating. I remember probably the two acts that I tried really hard to get, and they were young and just beginning to hit, were Bette Midler and Elton John. They had their first hit, and it just mushroomed so quickly. But in Elton John, my first bid was $250. And I thought I had it, and then the agent called back and he said, Doug, the record's going up the charts. We can't do it. We need 500. And I said, okay, 500. And I remember we got up to 1,000. And then he said, Doug, it's just too big. And Roger Abramson brought him to Music Hall.
Boy.
But, you know, this was happening in like a 3-week period. It was just 250 to 500 to 1,000. And boom, selling out Music Hall.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no, or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in the words how wonderful life is while you're in the world. The moss, well, a few of the verses, well, they've got me quite cross. But the sun's been quite kind while I wrote this song. It's for people like you that keep it turned on. So excuse me for getting, but these things I do, you see, I've forgotten if they're green or they're blue. Anyway, the thing is, what I really mean, yours are the sweetest eyes I've ever seen. You can tell everybody this is the song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in the words how wonderful life is while you're in. I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in the words how wonderful life is while you're in the world.
So I didn't get Elton John or Bette Midler. Wow. What can you do?
We're visiting with Doug Yeager, catching up on the good old days and also catching up on what's been happening recently. Doug has co-written, co-produced a documentary film called Free to Rock. There'll be a screening of it coming up this Friday. Doors open at noon. A screening starts at 1. There'll be a question and answer and a discussion afterwards over at UC in the Main Street Cinema there on campus. Where did the idea of doing this project come from, Doug?
Well, I had gone to college in France, 1966-67, studying international relations. My best American friend there was a singer-guitarist, and at the time I booked him on TV in Marseille, and we were just best buddies. His name was Nick Binkley. So when I booked my first tour, actually my first engagement for the three Cincinnati acts in Saint-Tropez, France, I came back to X to college and told him, and he was excited, and he said, well, I want to be in the tour. And he said, let's go to Paris, and booked him in Paris. So we got in his car, we drove to Paris, we booked him in Paris, booked him in DF, and he became part of that tour. We had actually four acts on the tour. So when the tour ended, he said, well, I'm going back to Tunisia. He and I used to go to Tunisia on our vacations and get in trouble, and I did actually write a research paper there. We probably got in more trouble than spent time schooling. And he was engaged to an American girl in the Peace Corps. So he says, I'm going back to Tunisia to see Judy, and we'll stay in touch. But back in those days, there was no internet. There were no faxes. In fact, if you wanted to call America, it meant going down to the post office, writing down a number, giving it to a cashier there, and you go sit down and wait 3 hours for them to call you, and they send you to booth 23, and then you can make your call. And so communications were so difficult that we disappeared from each other's ether. And I had been trying to find him for years. I think 37 years go by, and I look on the internet, and I see in the San Francisco Chronicle an old article, and it says, Nick Binkley and the Street Dogs return on a tour from Russia. And I'm going, good, Nick. And then I'm reading halfway down, and it says, this story is even more interested, because when he doesn't have his touring with his band and his current hit record in Russia, he's vice chairman of the board of Bank of America Corporation. So, all right. And so I ordered some of his CDs and learned his daughter was an actress living in New York, and my daughter was an actress living in Hollywood. And so I wrote him a letter. This was 2004, around this time of the year. And he called me right back, and we talked for 45 minutes. It was like nothing had changed in 37 years. And he said, my two kids live in New York, and I'm coming often, so let's have dinner. We had dinner for 4 hours. We went back to San Diego, and we were emailing each other every day. And then he gave me a call maybe a month later, and he said, my daughter Pepper's in her first Broadway play. Will you go with me to the opening? His wife had passed away the previous year, so he was like getting away from the corporate world and just enjoying life. And I think in the position he was more trusting with old friends than with corporate business people he would meet. And I later found out socially he only hung out with musicians and artists. So he had two different worlds totally. And so we went three straight nights to his daughter's play. And so we're having dinner down around Times Square, and he was leaving the next day back to San Diego, and he starts telling me about his Russian rocker friends. There was a negotiation going on between the White House and the Kremlin around 1974. They had a big famine, and they had no grain to feed their people. And so we said we would send them wheat, but we want you to allow Jews to get out of Russia, because there was a great history of anti-Semite pogroms against Jews in Soviet Union and Russia before that. So every Russian rock musician who was Jewish, and of course the only Russian rock musicians were underground because rock and roll was forbidden. But those who were Jewish, they applied. And like one of our main characters in the film, who we co-wrote the story with, he married a Jewish girl who had two kids and no husband, and she couldn't qualify to go to Israel unless she had a husband. And so all of a sudden, they started to make their way out of the Soviet Union. And basically, they would be sent by trains to Vienna. And while in Vienna, they would be met by an Israeli official who would give them a passport and a plane ticket to Tel Aviv. Except none of the rockers went to Israel. They all continued down to Rome, where they learned if they applied for political exile status, it would take some time, but they could get a passport and come to America. And so that's what all the rockers did. And most of them ended up in San Francisco. And Nick, at that time, was vice president at Chase Bank. And so he got a loft for them to live in, to rehearse, to record. And they all became his best friends and then became his band also. And so it was, you know, with those guys that he learned all these stories. And they all told him, and with all seriousness, that they all believed it was rock and roll that brought down the Soviet Empire, not all the other historical reasons that you'll see in history books, that rock and roll was the biggest factor. And so Nick is telling me this at dinner, and I'm thinking back, because in Gorbachev years, I was a consultant to the U.S. State Department and the Soviet Ministry of Culture in bringing American acts to Soviet Union and Soviet acts to America. So I had worked over there. I knew the lay of the land. I knew how closed it was. And I'd worked years earlier with Lionel Hampton and Lena Horne and Michael Urbaniak from Poland. So I worked with a lot of jazz acts, and I knew the history of jazz in Europe and how Hitler had banned it and Stalin did, because they realized it had a freedom of expression they couldn't allow their people to have. I said, well, Nick, you should make a documentary. That sounds like a great idea. And he said, well, why don't we do it together? And I didn't say yes. I said, Nick, I've been involved with a lot of projects. They end up being very expensive, take a long time. They're artistic success, and I lose my shirt. And he said, well, we can do this in 2 years. And so I said, well, let me think about it. And I went back home to my computer, and I put the words on the internet about power of rock and roll versus communism in Eastern Europe and Soviet Union. And I found 200 articles. They were even teaching classes at universities in Kiev and St. Petersburg on the subject. And it's a subject no one in America had ever heard about or thought about. Then I wrote a white paper and sent it out to all my friends in the industry. And I said, guys, I'm almost going to be 60 years old, and I can't get involved in any more long projects where I'm going to lose my shirt. But they all wrote back, and literally almost all of them said, wow, this is a story no one knows. You've got to do it. And so 2 weeks later, Nick and I were, and Valeri, the one Soviet rock pioneer, he had formed the first group in the history of the Soviet Union. And he and Nick owned a recording studio in San Diego. So Valeri, Nick, and I got on a plane to Latvia because we learned that's where rock and roll began in the Soviet Union, because the Soviets had erected 2,500 radio jamming stations around its perimeter, which prevented not only propaganda news, but music from coming in. And the only place they really couldn't prevent it was in the Baltic states, which were sitting on the Baltic Sea, right across from Sweden and Finland and Scandinavia, and they couldn't erect jamming stations because these jamming stations they erected were, oh, like the size of the Pentagon. I mean, but they were like 300-400 feet high. Just massive wires going back and forth. It was just all these antennas strung together, and that's how they would block the radio and jam it. But they couldn't do it in the Baltic states, and everything began in Riga, Latvia, and that's where we went. We knew that this may be hard to prove, the thesis that rock and roll was a contributing factor to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the communist system. So I got him to agree. I said, Nick, we'll hire a film crew. We will go out for 2 weeks to interviews, and if we can't prove it, we just had a fun vacation. In fact, when he kept pushing me to go with him to Latvia, he said, come on, Doug, it'll be fun like when we were in college. You know, so it was like we were two college kids, except 60 years old instead of 20. And so we went over there. This was June of 2005, and the very first person Valeri took us to was his childhood friend, Pitz Andersons, who changed his name to Pete Anderson because he wanted to become American. And Pete had been arrested a dozen times by the KGB. There was a high school jazz band. He played piano in that band, and in some of their concerts, he would all of a sudden break out and do Long Tall Sally or Fats Domino song, and that kicked him out of school for that. So he had been an early pioneer, and they beat him. They tortured him nearly to death. It's a scene in the film where it's the only scene where we reenacted a scene where the KGB were beating him nearly to death, and he then fought for his life for 2 weeks in the hospital. He then had to go into exile for 11 years in a shack out in the country with no water or electricity. At one point, 2 years later, he did come back into Riga, and you were allowed, it had progressed to the point by 1972 that they would allow rock bands to play if it was in a college, but only the college students could come. Why they made that decision, who knows? So Pete went to that concert, and then they called him up on stage because they, you know, he was like the father of rock music there. He sings two songs, and he realized he made a big mistake. And so on his way out, and he left immediately, and that's when the KGB beat him nearly to death. And then right after that, his son was born. And so he's in the hospital with his wife and his son, and the son was perfectly normal and healthy. And the next day, a doctor comes, said, we need to take him for some tests, normal tests, and then we'll bring him back. And they never saw their son again.
Oh, my.
And we went to his place, and he had huge posters of Ricky Nelson and Elvis and Fats Domino, Little Richard and Chuck Berry. And we realized, here's a guy singing Ricky Nelson songs, Fats Domino songs, innocent songs. And if the Kremlin felt so threatened by him, then we realized we had a story, except we just had to prove it and get stronger voices or more respected voices to support the thesis. So one reason it took 12 years from the time we began filming to the time we aired it on PBS in America last year and this year in Europe and Israel is you just don't start off getting Mikhail Gorbachev and Jimmy Carter to do interviews for a documentary film. And so we didn't get Gorbachev until after we had interviewed the president of Latvia. We didn't get the president of Latvia till we had interviewed the Latvian ambassador to the United States, et cetera, et cetera. And it's same with the rock bands. We couldn't have gotten the Beach Boys if we hadn't already interviewed the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, who were the first American rock band to tour the Soviet Union, sent over by President Carter. And our first rock and roll president, most people don't remember that. He was the first president to use rock bands at his rallies to draw young people in. And when he ran for governor of Georgia, too, he would invite Bob Dylan and the band, and the Allman Brothers became his best friend. So Jimmy Carter, he understood this story very well. He was a great interview. Mikhail Gorbachev had been a fan of Elvis Presley, and again, he understand. They both supported our thesis. And then we got the deputy secretary general of NATO, who had been a former U.S. ambassador to Moscow. He's a rock drummer on the side when he's not in those positions. And then we got the former chief of foreign counterintelligence of the KGB, Major General Oleg Kalugin. And because basically the KGB was the one that was at war with rock music and rock musicians and their fans and the Stasi in East Germany. And near the end of the film, he says, when you have an opposing force that you're trying to overcome, And he said, you can do it militarily, or you can do it through culture and music. And he said that that is always more successful, and that's precisely what caused the demise of the Soviet Union. So here we have the head of the KGB saying that near the end of the film.
That's pretty fascinating.
And of course, then we interview the key Iron Curtain rockers from the era who braved this long struggle, like Pete Anderson and Valeri. And in order to get footage from Russia, we had to get someone powerful there to back us. Also, when Nick Binkley and I, we were first in Latvia, we had death threats from former KGB head in Ukraine. So we needed someone powerful. And the first rock musician who had a group that was allowed to record soft rock music, not hard rock, and he became the first concert promoter of rock music in the Soviet Union. His name is Stas Naman. He's a cultural icon in Russia. And so he became our partner, and he was able to get footage for us and to get interviews with the biggest Russian rock stars who started under the Soviet era. So that was very important, and he provided political protection for us. So it just was a long evolutionary period of building up. As I said, we couldn't get the Beach Boys till we had Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. We couldn't get Billy Joel till we had the Beach Boys. We couldn't get Elton John and Metallica until we had Billy Joel. So it was a long process, and took 3 years while we were working on the films to negotiate the music license. And there were several songs we wanted in the film, but we just couldn't do because they wanted too much money and we couldn't afford it. So it's very involved, but I'm proud of it. And at the beginning, we went to Washington and we presented screenings with panel discussions at the U.S. Capitol for Congress, at the U.S. State Department for the Foreign Service officers, and at the Council on Foreign Relations, and then Georgetown University in their large theater. The School of Foreign Service presented us in association with the NEA and NEH, who helped us with funding. So from that, the State Department has sponsored me in the last 18 months. I toured Latvia, France, Tunisia, 3 tours of Germany, Czech Republic. I just came back a few months back from touring Slovakia. And next year, our embassies in Bulgaria, Romania, Poland, Slovenia are talking to me about coming over for discussions, because it's not only the 50th anniversary of the World Youth Revolution that was fueled by rock music in 68-69, which some people in America may not know. Not only was the youth revolution supporting civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and all the big rallies in Washington and Woodstock, but Paris was on fire, and so was Warsaw, and so was... Anyway, some are doing 30th anniversary symposiums on Fall of the Iron Curtain, which was in 1989, which will be 30 years next year. So in either of those cases, I'm doing more, and some colleges here in America are having me come for those reasons too next year. The response has been faster in Europe and of greater interest in Europe because they lived it, and everything we're showing in film and talking about, they know very well, even the high school students. Whereas in America, sadly, our educational system is not as good as it should be for the masses, and a lot of people I talk to under 40 years old have never heard of the Soviet Union or the Cold War or the Iron Curtain. So it's a longer educational period in America to talk about these subjects, where it's still fresh in the mind of people in Europe.
And the film Free to Rock that Doug Yeager, our guest, co-wrote and co-produced, is going to be screened this coming Friday at the University of Cincinnati at the Main Street Cinema on campus there. Noontime, doors open, 1 o'clock, the film begins. Hang around afterwards for a discussion and question and answer. And before I forget, is it or will it be available on DVD?
Oh, it is. If you go to Amazon and just type in Free to Rock, you have 2 choices. If you have Amazon Prime, you can upload it, download it, whatever it is, stream it, or you can buy a 2-disc DVD. The first disc is the film that was shown on PBS. But the second disc, Nick Binkley and I made, is 2 hours long on the making of the film. I will say that this is not just a political history film that would bore the average rock and roll fan. We have not only interviews, but we have performances by Elvis Presley, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Bruce Springsteen, Elton John, Billy Joel, Metallica. So it's a rock and roll film also, and was huge hit when it was presented at the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles and at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. In fact, last August, 14 months ago, I was flown to Germany to show it at the Wacken Open Air Festival. And for many of you who are not into heavy metal music, it's the largest heavy metal festival in the world. And truly, I hadn't been listening to heavy metal since Black Sabbath, and so I wasn't really sure what was going to happen, whether they would stop and watch and listen to a film. But they showed it at midnight, you know, with 100,000 people, and we had a press conference, and the U.S. Embassy sent their consul general to participate. And so that was great. In Slovakia, we went to a big rock festival, the Pohada Festival, and it's also played at the Woody Guthrie Center in Tulsa. So it's not just a film for people into political science or international relations. It tells a great story about rock and roll and the power of rock music and how it can affect change in society, even authoritarian societies.
And we might mention that Kiefer Sutherland is the narrator in the film.
Oh, yes. Our director is four-time Emmy winner Jim Brown, who's done many music films, and Kiefer Sutherland is the narrator. I felt very lucky to get him because he was my first choice. And I just love his edgy voice of Jack Bauer from 24. And he was so good to work with and has really enhanced the film a lot, I feel.
Hey, Doug, congratulations. A great job.
Thank you, Brian. So nice to talk to you after...
Decades?
Almost 50 years.
Yeah.
WEBN days. If you're not working that day, I hope you can make it down to UC and I can see you.
I do plan on it. Doug Yeager, my guest, who co-wrote, co-produced Free to Rock, the documentary film, going to be screened this coming Friday at UC in the Main Street Cinema on the campus there. 12 noon, the doors open, 1 o'clock, the show begins. Stick around afterwards, a Q&A and a discussion on the documentary film Free to Rock. And for WVXU, I'm Brian O'Donnell. What you wanna do? But no, honey, lay off them shoes and don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but lay over my blue suede shoes. Let's go, cat! Burn my house, steal my car, drink my liquor from an old fruit jar. Well, do anything that you wanna do, but honey, lay off of my shoes and don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but lay over my blue suede shoes. Lock it. For the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, 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 but don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but take the help of my blue suede shoes. Well, it's blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Yeah! Blue, blue, blue suede shoes, baby. Blue, blue, blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but take the help of my blue suede shoes.